You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and joining you on January the 22nd, hopefully a happy 62nd birthday to André Tschmiel, the former Tour of Flanders and Milan-San Remo winner who during his career represented five different nations and was the most terrifying man in each one of them. My name is Daniel Freiber. I survived my harrowing encounter with André 15 years ago, and I am the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we have a lot to discuss, including the resumption of World Tour cycling at the Tour Down Under. Joining me, helping me today, is an unchanged lineup of Rob Hatch. Hello, Rob.
Good evening.
And emerging from his mountain of fan mail.
Oh, hello, Daniel. How many of those five nations can you name off the top of your head? I'm assuming you, all of them.
Yes. Well, do you know what? I did have a doubt about one of them. So the five are Russia, Soviet Union, Ukraine, Moldova, and Belgium. I had a bit of a doubt about Russia because if you go back and look at, well, other sources, other media who have quoted this bizarre stat, some of them refer to four nations that he represented. And Russia is the one that's left off. And I think he possibly represented Russia, well, in, I think, it between 1990 and 1990, or 1991, possibly, he represented Russia.
And, of course, won the famous, the very, very muddy, wet edition of Paris-Roubaix in 94. One of the sort of, oh, I suppose, one of those iconic races of the 90s, really, that edition, wasn't it? It was a good one, a very good one. André Tschmiel, kind of, that race got the right winner, didn't it? The sort of hard-as-nails, clichéd, kind of East European, ex-Soviet bloc, you know, softened himself a little bit by becoming a man of Flanders.
I have referred in the podcast before to that terrifying encounter I had with him. Have you chaps ever had a 25-minute, probably 30-minute conversation with someone who did not make eye contact with you a single time in those 25 minutes? Quite extraordinary. Chaps, how are we doing otherwise?
Very well, thank you. Very well. Travelling about. No airport lounges this week.
Airport
no danger
hotel?
Of Rog knocking. Well, there's a hotel, but there's no danger of Rog knocking at the door because he assured me last week he was going home before going to altitude.
So you mean he's not in the suite. Adjacent suite with an interlinking door?
No. He says I'm in a suite. I know that I'm on a video call, but it's not that posh. Come on.
Now, how are we?
You are in London, Rob.
I'm in London, yes. I'm in London this
Doing
week.
Doing what? Oh, you can't say. You can't say. Top secret. Lionel, you're in not Watford.
I am, but Rob and I will be united next week, won't we? I was thinking the Tour Down Under, the racing is underway in Australia. This time next week, it'll be underway in Europe, won't it, with the Challenge Mallorca. I'll be over there with Rob, visiting the home of cycling. So looking forward to that.
Can't wait to have you over.
Lionel, I will put you on notice already at this early juncture of this podcast. I think we're about 4 minutes in. If you refer to the Tour Down Under as a pre-season friendly or the Charity Shield or the Community Shield once, I am going to press stop on the recorder and there will be changes to the lineup next week. With that, last week we premiered a sort of revamped news roundup. Not really a news roundup. What is it? A sort of news kind of everyone bring...
Well, everyone's sick of news, aren't they, at the minute? So it's a bit just, you know, like a conversation.
Come dine with me kind of affair. Everyone brings something to the news roundup. We're each going to contribute one sort of talking point, one news item that's caught our eye over the last 7 days. Rob, can you go first?
Yeah, I'm going to go first. And on the back of invitations given out to Liège, Bastogne-Liège today for Q36.5, Tom Pidcock's new team, and Tudor Pro Cycling with Alaphilippe and he or she there. What a lineup for that race that
and,
could be
and,
as well.
And who else, Rob?
I'm sorry, Larry.
I'm never going to get that watch if you snub Larry. Go on.
Monument winner-elect Larry Warbass. Sorry, mate. They've been invited to Liège. I think those two teams with those three signings, sorry, four if you include Larry, they're probably going to get the pick of invites to the classics, aren't there, this year? You know, all the classics organisers are going to want a Pidcock and Alaphilippe, he or she, maybe even a Warbass too. So that's good news for Tom Pidcock. Pidcock, though, in perhaps a more eye-raising bit of news, has stated that he will skip the Tour de France. Problem is, would he have had the choice to skip the Tour de France? Because would his team have been invited? Maybe he knows something we don't. And maybe there is going to be this extra team invited to the Tour. And they're going to have to, he's going to have to turn around and say, no, sorry, lads, I've signed for you, but I'm not riding the Tour this year.
Did we talk about this last week, chaps, who was likely to be invited? Usually, and Rob, I don't know if you've got any info on this, usually the wild cards, or certainly in the last couple of years, have been announced around about now, this week. And I'm very confident, I've got on fairly good authority, that Uno X should be confident, should feel pretty confident. Don't know what you chaps have heard, what your feelings are.
I think with Uno X, you've been hearing it in a lot of the sort of pre-season declarations and interviews from a lot of their riders. They seem sort of confident they were going back, that they were going to get the nod again. You know, we've had Abrahamson talking about, and you spoke about him last week, Daniel, as well. He wants to go and try and win a Tour stage. Obviously, pretty obvious thing for most bike riders to say. But I think with a little more realism and a little more promise and a little more confidence this year, given his performances last year. So I would be very surprised if they would be left out. I know that there was maybe a bit of doubt about Total Energie, maybe, but again, I think I'd be surprised if a Tour de France organiser left out all French team. You know,
they've had a good run, though, those boys. Well. They've had a good run. That said, they did, of course, win one of the more prestigious stages, or one of the more spectacular stages of last year's Tour de France, with the criminally underrated Anthony Turgis.
Bit harsh to win a stage and say be thrown back to fine leg and
on your bike, lads, have a rest. On your bike,
well,
lads.
There's that as well,
or not. Well, very interesting. So Pidcock is opting out, effectively, whether he's invited or not, he's opting out of the Tour de France. Something that caught my eye, you chaps might have noticed it was the Visma Lisa Bikes media day last week, and we've got some content coming from that, various interviews. Our man Fran Reyes was there, speaking to riders, male and female, coaches as well. Jonas Vingegaard was obviously one of the star attractions, and he was asked about various sort of news items, news stories, as well as about his race program. There's been a lot of talk over the last few months about carbon monoxide. We've talked about it on the podcast. There was that big sort of kerfuffle, that big fuss before the Tour de France last year. Story in Escape Collective about top teams, three teams, using carbon monoxide to optimize their altitude training and measure their hemoglobin mass. Jonas Vingegaard asked last week what he thought of it. He called on the governing bodies to ban carbon monoxide rebreathing, I think for performance enhancement, because it has been suggested that it could be used for performance enhancement, and just for measuring hemoglobin, which is what his team had been doing. The UCI have also, of course, we know, they've asked WADA to ban carbon monoxide rebreathing. We're expecting some news on that at the end of January. Just a couple of other things Vingegaard said. He confirmed his team only used carbon monoxide to test hemoglobin volume after altitude camps. We sort of knew that. And he also talked about the health issues that could be if someone was using carbon monoxide rebreathing for performance enhancement. Chaps, I've been doing a bit of research about this, speaking to various people in teams. And again, and we've said this before this winter, the consensus seems to be that the likelihood of a team using this for performance enhancement is pretty remote. That seems to be the feeling. The other question, if this is indeed banned, if WADA, they meet UCI's request to ban this, is there any way of testing for it? Any reliable way of testing for it? Well, carbon monoxide can be detected in blood tests, however, only for a few hours. And also, again, in those conversations I had with various people in the know today, there's a lot of contamination. We've all got we would all probably have a little bit of carbon monoxide in our system from pollution and so on and so forth. So it would probably be very, very difficult to detect. So you might ask, is a ban really a bit pointless? Another sort of funny story that came up in the course of those conversations I had today. I was told a story about a rugby player. I won't say the nationality, a professional rugby player who in his blood tests had an unnaturally high hematocrit of about 60 something. So much so that I think his team or the people who were testing him were convinced he was using EPO. And they tested him, retested him, and he was clean on all the tests. They're pretty sure he wasn't using EPO. And then they started asking him about what else he'd been doing. Was there anything else that could explain these unnaturally high hematocrit levels? Apparently, he'd been hitting a shisha pipe every day after training. And presumably, the carbon monoxide from this had sent his hematocrit sky high. But of course, that is the way that carbon monoxide abuse, rebreathing for performance enhancement, could possibly be detectable indirectly via the biological passport. There you go.
Wow.
Lionel, you've got something very different for us.
Yeah, some sad news, unfortunately, but I would like to mention Doug Shapiro, one of the pioneers of American professional cycling. He died this week after a fall from a cliff in California. He was walking on trails and was found on the beach, and initial observations suggest that his injuries were consistent with a big fall. Foul play not suspected. He was 65 years old, and so obviously a tragic accident, it appears. But I wanted to mention him because certainly for people of my generation, and especially American cycling fans of my age and a bit older, Doug Shapiro was one of those pioneers who really sort of barged the door open for American cycling. Jonathan Boyer had been the first American to ride the Tour de France in 1981, and he was followed by Greg LeMond in 1984. But Shapiro has the honour of being the third American to start the Tour de France in 1985. He'd won the Coors Classic, which was at the time the biggest race in the United States. He'd won that in 1984, and he was asked to guest at certain key races in Europe by the Dutch Quantum team. Now, the Quantum team was formed out of that tension between Peter Post and Jan Raas, who became these sort of huge, legendary, rival director sportif figures of the 1980s. Jan Raas finished his racing career riding for the Quantum team, and Doug Shapiro, although he was racing for the US 7-Eleven team in the United States, was invited over to ride some of the classics and take part in the Tour de France in 1985. And he lined up in that Quantum team alongside Joep Zoetemelk and Adrie van der Poel, you know, father of Mathieu van der Poel, of course. And he finished 74th in that Tour de France, and then went on to become part of that first American team, 7-Eleven, that rode the Tour de France in 1986. And so Shapiro really at the vanguard of American professional cycling. And I suppose I wanted to mention it because not only was he one of those trailblazers, but that Dutch Quantum team founded in 1984 that Shapiro rode for in the 1985 Tour de France is a direct ancestor of the current Visma Lisa bike team. It went through various iterations, Super Confex, Buckler, handful of other sponsors, Rabobank, of course, for a long time, and then 10 years ago, Lotto NL Jumbo. And Doug Shapiro, certainly for me, the one thing I do remember is that the 7-Eleven cycling team in about 1988 or 89 brought out a video basically showcasing professional cycling, how to race, how to train, and Shapiro featured in that. And I remember watching that multiple times when I was a youngster. After retiring, he set up Shapiro and Associates to work as an expert witness and consultant in bicycle accident litigation. So sad news about Doug Shapiro, and it goes without saying that our condolences go to his family and friends. But I wanted to recognise the significant part that he played in that first great wave of pro cycling popularity in the US.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Indeed. Now, if you're hiring somebody to work for your company, You'll want to find the right candidate. Of course you will, but you also want to hire somebody quickly, because all of the while that you've left that vacancy unfilled, your business is incurring hidden costs and your staff or colleagues are covering the gap. So whatever business or industry you're in, the best way to find amazing candidates quickly is by using Indeed. Indeed sponsored jobs will help you stand out and hire someone quickly. According to Indeed's data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have a 45% greater number of applications than non-sponsored jobs. But it's not just about the number of applicants, it's about the quality of them too. And with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts. You only pay for the results that Indeed deliver. In the time that I've been talking to you just now, 23 hires have been made on Indeed worldwide. There's no need to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring process right now with Indeed. Cycling Podcast listeners will get a £100 sponsored job credit so that your jobs will get more visibility at indeed.com/cycle. Just go to indeed.com/cycle now and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on the Cycling Podcast. Indeed.com/cycle. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring, Indeed, is all you need.
There's nothing like being in the stands cheering on your favorite team. Game Time is your hack to unlocking amazing tickets in just a few taps. Plus, their Game Time guarantee means you can trust you'll get 100% authentic tickets at the best price. Fees are always included, so what you see is what you pay. Get the best deals on sports tickets. Download the Game Time app and create an account to start searching for tickets to upcoming games and events. Swipe, tap, ticket, go. Game Time.
Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion, it's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Well, chaps, part one finished, done. No one mentioned cyclocross. That is a rarity for winter episodes of Cycling Podcast. A welcome rarity as far as I'm concerned. Although a lot of people seem to have a very good time in Benidorm at the weekend. We should mention at least who didn't win, shouldn't we? Wout van Aert. He was the main attraction, star attraction in Benidorm at the weekend. Who won, chaps, the men's race? Thibaut Nace. And who won the women's race? Femme van Empel.
Is this a quiz? Femme van Empel.
Well, I don't know. I'm just hoping to make the podcast a little bit more interactive.
I had a friend at the cyclocross at the weekend, actually. And he might have been the only non-Brit and Belgian in the place, actually. He's a Spaniard who went over to Benidorm. He flew over there at the weekend. Very good cyclist. He's a policeman now, a very good cyclist in his youth days. He actually rode with a couple of current pros. He was sort of in the Valverde era in the under-23s. He raced against Valverde a couple of times, so really still into it. Yeah, he decided to take the weekend off and got a few messages, and he absolutely loved the event. And I know it's a really popular event with those who've been, actually, the Benidorm one. Not always to purist liking, you know. Some purists will say, well, the course is nothing, it's too fast, whatever. But I've commentated it a couple of times as well. I like it. It's quick, it's a different spectacle. And in a sport, and we've been talking about this with One Cycling last week and trying to get more people involved, cyclocross really is a very, very niche part of the sport, isn't it? You know, us.
Very, very, very niche, I would say. Very niche.
I do like it, but I have to recognise that it's very much still restricted to the Benelux, isn't it, in general? We've had World Cups in Dublin, this one in Benidorm.
Is that why it's in Benidorm?
Yes. In all seriousness, joking aside, this round of the World Cup has been one of the few success stories in trying to globalise that sport.
Well, yeah, I mean, sore subject. My mate, Pippo Pozzato, of course, had a had an absolute nightmare before Christmas because he's also trying to do something similar in Sardinia. And of course, that round was cancelled, wasn't it? Because of dreadful, dreadful weather. I was very curious actually to see how he got on with that endeavour, because that is a part of Sardinia. Well, Sardinia itself in winter is a pretty lonely place, windswept place it can be. And I was curious to see who would have turned up, whether the locals would have turned out to see that race, but we were denied that opportunity, weren't we?
Have we got a minute just to sort of give a state of the nation,
no,
where we are with the Cyclocross World Cup, maybe? I mean, I don't know. Two rounds remaining. Belgian rider Michael van Tuylenhout is the overall leader in the World Cup at the moment, having won two early rounds. He won in Dublin in Ireland and Namur in Belgium. Matthew van der Poel has ridden three, won three over the Christmas period, but he is languishing in the standings, but simply because the likes of van Tuylenhout and Toon Aerts and Eli Isabit have been a lot more consistent in riding, but also getting results. Wout van Aert won in Dendermonde, the first event of 2025. Thibaut Nice winning in Benidorm, of course. Two rounds still to go, and then it will be the World Championships in Liévin, which is basically Lens, isn't it, in northeastern France. That's where the Worlds are this year. Wout van Aert just missing out on the podium in Benidorm, not because he stopped for ham, egg and chips and a pint of lager or anything like that on the way round.
He didn't go the red
but
line,
he did put it down to having done a lot of road training, looking ahead to the road season, so not prioritising the World Cup cyclocross this year, although, you know, he has won one of the two rounds that he's ridden. So that's where we are with the cyclocross. Daniel, you'll be relieved to know that in a couple of weeks or so, it will be all over for another year.
In a couple of seconds, we'll be talking about proper cycling, road cycling. No, I should just say, on the old cyclocross, Benidorm, one of the people who did enjoy it and who did watch it, I know, is our good friend, founder of Rafa, the clothing company, used to sponsor us, Simon Mottram, because he texted me about it. More about Simon Mottram and his correspondence with us.
Has he been
later
on Points of View?
chaps, the road cycling has started. The women's race came before the men's race. Obviously, we cover women's racing in great depth in the cycling podcast, Femina. However, Rob, can you just update us on the results of the women's race?
Well, the women's Tour down, there was a three-day race. There was a breakaway win on day one. Danjek Hingefeld of Ceratizit WNT holding everybody off as they got to snap a point. And on the second day, the three-day race, it was Noemi Rugg, a Swiss rider from EF Education Oatly, who put in a perfectly timed attack right on that final ascent of the famous Willunga Hill to take the stage win. And she took over the GC lead. The final day of racing, that went to Sterling. It was a circuit race, just over 100 kilometres. It was a stage win for Chloe Dygert of Canyon SRAM Zonderkrypto, as they're now known. And Rugg held on resiliently to claim that GC prize. So the first GC of the year and of her career, actually, to Rugg.
An episode of the cycling podcast, Feminine, coming very soon as well, Daniel. That will be out in a day or so.
Excellent. And chaps, in the men's race, it is play 2-1-2 for the Wombat. Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe's Wombat, as he likes to be referred. I don't know.
I was
going to
say, where's this coming from?
As the Wombat, but he's referred to generally, widely, I'm told, in Australia, I believe, allegedly, as the Wombat. Sam Welsford, he has won each of the two opening stages, or stages 1 and 2. He's in the ochre jersey, mate. He's leading the race.
Curious thing about Sam Welsford, by the way, those two races, he's been doing a bit of Criterium racing as well. You know, they have the pre-Tour Down Under crit. He won that. There was the Aussie Criterium Championships. He won that. So he's not in a race that he's finished this year, because he didn't finish the Aussie Road Nationals. He's unbeaten in all the races he's ridden this year. So it's been a 1-1 DNF, 1-1 so far.
And chaps, it almost feels unfair. Well, the sprints so far have almost felt unfair, because Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe's lead out train at the Tour Down Under is, to say the least, formidable. Danny van Poppel is on lead out duties. Ooh. He's the last man for Sam Welsford. But he also has Lawrence.
He's been put into the book though, hasn't he?
He's done what?
He's been put into the book. Referee's taken his name.
He's been cautioned. More on that. Maybe you can tell us about that in a second, Rob. But Lawrence Pithy is also there. We might hear from him later in the podcast, actually. He's making his debut for Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. And, of course, he was at times last year for Groupama. He was doing bunch sprints himself. He was sort of a frontline sprinter, and he's slotted into Welsford's train. And Welsford, he's had to fight quite hard for those victories, hasn't he? Particularly today. So that's Wednesday's. Is it Wednesday's stage? Yeah, Wednesday's stage. He was dropped on, which hill was it? Mingler's Hill, mate? Mingler's Hill? Mingle's Hill? And he also had a crash. And he came under a bit of pressure. There were some attacks on the climb as well. But he managed to get back on and won the sprint pretty convincingly after an excellent lead out from Van Poppel. About whose yellow card, Rob? You going to tell us?
Yeah, so the new yellow card warning system has been brought in to try and regulate sort of naughty manoeuvres and things like that this year. And the basic issue is that if you're yellow carded more than once in a race, you can then be thrown out of the race. He was obviously relegated for what was deemed to be a deviation on stage two. But in addition to the usual punishment that sort of thing brings, right down to the back of the group that you came in, if you're not au fait with how that works. He also got a yellow card. Daniel, while you were talking about the crashes, can I just have one word before we forget for poor Dylan from...
Oh, can I just have one word? Well, you can have a word about Dylan Van Baarle. Just one word about the... In case we don't revisit it, I presume because the yellow card, the news about the yellow card had not been announced when the broadcast finished, I presume this was for his manoeuvre after the lead out.
Yeah.
And this was a good example of what lead out men have been told to do now, carry on sprinting. However, in carrying on sprinting, he very smartly, it was Lunt, wasn't it? He very smartly sort of nudged the, Rob, what's the team name now? Picnic Post NL?
Picnic Post NL, yes.
Yeah. He sort of manoeuvred the Picnic Post NL sprinter, Tobias Lunt, into or towards the barriers. And
well,
I
more,
say smart,
more than that, Daniel, I'd say he closed the door on him to stop him challenging Welsford, really. I mean, he moved significantly to the right when you see the overhead shot. I mean...
Yeah, and this could be a bit of a problem, couldn't it? Because if that becomes one of the functions of your lead out... Mm. Men sort of post hoc after they've done their job, if they then do the secondary job of taking care of some of your, you know, would-be rivals, then it becomes a bit of a problem. And that is one thing that might happen if people do carry on sprinting or carry on after their lead out rather than just sort of vaporizing into the middle of the bunch, which of course brings its own safety issues and risks.
Yeah, it's a tough one, that, isn't it? The instruction to carry on sprinting when basically your finish line is, what, 200, 150, whatever, however many metres from the finish line. The job of leading out is to do the job and then get out of the way as safely as possible. Trying to define what is as safe as possible is tricky. And I suppose it's all about deviating from the line and impeding other riders. And so... probably the correct decision. I hope we're not going to go down the route of football here and debate yellow cards endlessly. I'm very much in favour of referee's decision is final, but that seemed like a fair application of the new rule. Should also just say, as well as the punishment, if you get two yellow cards in the same race, you can be disqualified. It's I think, at the discretion of the race jury. You can be disqualified and then suspended from racing for 7 days. But six yellow cards over a year's rolling period can also result in a 30-day suspension. So it's going to be interesting to see which riders pick up yellow cards as the season goes on and what the transgressions are. Because it doesn't just apply to sprinting, does it? It applies to... any kind of irregular move, bringing the sport into disrepute. The jury now has a kind of quite an effective warning system. Yellow card is quite a serious warning, because Van Poppel will think a little bit more carefully in future sprints over the rest of the race what he's going to do once he's finished his lead out job. And I suppose will riders think, well, If I lead out the rider and take a yellow card for the team, but we win the stage, is that going to be a fair trade-off? So it's going to be really interesting to see how it is applied.
I think we should introduce the yellow card system on the Cycling Podcast every episode.
Just imagine walking a suspension tightrope that stages 18, 19, 20 and missing the cup final of the Champs-Élysées if you get another yellow card.
You're lining up your Tour de France narrative arc already, aren't you, Rob? Brilliant work. It's only January the 22nd.
Deary me. Well, I do like to get the research in early. Daniel, before we move on, just a quick word on Dylan van Baarle, because... The poor lad began 2025 suffering from the same lack of luck that saw him crash out the Dauphiné, collarbone, and the Vuelta, hip fracture. A crash in the final couple of kilometres of the opening stage of the Tour Down Under saw him leave Australia with another broken collarbone. So first day of racing, he said he wanted to get back in, build up to a Giro appearance, the first Giro appearance since Belfast, believe it or not, when he last started the Giro, right at the start of his career. I mean, I'm pretty sure the Giro's not in danger, but that's not a good start, is it?
What about the classics, Rob? Are they in danger?
I think that would depend on the collarbone, wouldn't it? The early ones, perhaps. But, I mean, a collarbone, if it's a decent recovery and you get back, I mean, you could make opening weekend, couldn't you? But what kind of form would you be in? Who knows?
Another month from there to the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix. So he has got time, but yes, far from ideal for him.
Chaps, the decisive stages of the Tour Down Under still to come. I would suggest tomorrow's stage, so that's Thursday. That could be pretty decisive. And then we've got Willunga Hill, mate, on the last day.
You're talking about yellow cards. I think that's a yellow card. And you've done it three times now. So I think that's...
No, for three different climb names I've done it. And we established a few years ago anyway on the podcast that Old Willunga Hill, mate, was the official name of that particular climb as far as we were concerned.
To be fair, the time we were recording this particular episode, All My Away and Neighbours has just been on. So he's just carrying on the accent.
Well, the Arsenal game will be on in a minute if we don't hurry up. Tomorrow's stage, as I said, is pretty significant. There are a lot of climbs on the Tour Down Under route of about 2 kilometres, 2.5 kilometres. How many minutes of effort is that? Sort of less than 10. Less than 10. Anyway, and they're sort of the climbs that are going to decide this race. Chaps, any strong feelings about who is likely to win this race? A few of the favourites, a few of the men to watch. Narváez, of course, Jonathan Narváez, riding his first race for UAE. Came pretty close last year. Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe's leader, we think, is Finn Fisher-Black. He has come from UAE to Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. We might hear from him later on in the podcast. Jay Vine, of course, also running for UAE. Stephen Williams, last year's winner. Oscar Onley also came close last year. A couple of wild cards, Lapera of Decathlon AG2R, Nuroka of EF Education First. Anything you're particularly looking forward to, chaps, in those last few days?
I have to be honest, I'm watching the highlights in the morning of these races, so I want to stay on European time at the minute so I can prep for the start of my own season.
Last year, of course, we had Isaac Del Toro's big breakthrough. He won a stage as a teenager. There was a teenager who came pretty close to winning on the first day, Matthew Brennan, a British rider riding for Visma Lisa Bike. He's from Stockton. On Stockton, you chaps will know where that is. Is that in, that's somewhere up north? Is Stockton-on-Tees? Is that in Derbyshire?
That's the northeast. That's very much the northeast. Stockton-on-Tees.
Yeah, it's the northeast. Yeah, I told you.
Derbyshire's not the north.
I told you. Of course it's the north. He's 19 years old. Won some interesting races last year. Won the Porrex Trophy, which is in Croatia, is it not? Very fast finisher, obviously. Hasn't necessarily won a lot of races as an amateur, but to finish second in his first World Tour race, a bunch sprint, very impressive, I thought. And there could be some surprises like that in the course of the week, I would suggest. So, yeah. I
haven't seen the particular stat, but I know there's a lot of noise, Daniel, about Brendan's placing and how apparently it was an historic stat going forward in the, I think he was the first teenager or the youngest ever World Tour podium finisher, even younger than Juan Ayuso when he got there for UAE Emirates.
There's a lot of excitement about another teenager at the Tour Down Under as well, isn't there? Albert Phillipson of Little Trek, who's only 18 years old. And he has been significantly sort of, well, hyped, particularly in the Danish media. He is, of course, a Danish rider. And not only has he had excellent results as a junior, but some of the rides he's been posting in training have been extremely impressive, I believe. And yeah, some people fancy him to contend on general classification. He, of course, is riding for Little Trek. Maybe more about a Little Trek rider in a minute. Lionel, 26th edition of the Tour Down Under. You informed us before we started recording. I had in my head that it was the 25th.
No, not the 26th edition, because, of course, we missed a couple with the COVID pandemic.
Ah, 2 years out with COVID.
Is it the 25th edition?
It could well... I'd have to add it up.
It is the 25th edition. Yeah. So they've had quite a few legends down there going at the mat. I know that Mark Cavendish is down there at the moment. I think André Greipel is there as well. And they're really celebrating this 25th edition of the Tour Down
Under. Right, that clears it up. Because, Lionel, before we started recording, in the sort of postscript, the footnotes to last week's episode... there was some feedback about your diatribe, your monologue, your sneering monologue.
Oh, that's a bit far.
No, there was some feedback. There was some feedback about our discussion about One Cycling. Last week, of course, was the speculation episode. And we talked about the gathering momentum behind this project. Richard Plugger of Visma, Lisa Bike, CEO, is one of the masterminds, isn't he? We don't know exactly what it's going to look like, but it's certainly going to be an attempt to remodel, reinvent cycling's business model. And we had a letter from our good friend Simon Mottram, the aforementioned Simon Mottram, founder of Rafa Clothing. Simon said, "I don't have anything to do with One Cycling. Perhaps I'm just one of those marketing types, in inverted commas, who wants to see the sport reach more people and therefore be worth more. But surely I'm not the only person who looks at pro cycling and sees a slow decline or even crisis, flat or declining viewer numbers, an aging fan base, races and teams running out of money." Simon goes on, "If we are going to arrest the sport's decline and help it become more relevant to younger audiences, then surely it has to change. Not to make money for the sake of money, but being more valuable would be a sign that it is more exciting and relevant with a much brighter future. Simon would love to see us more open to change." He did use the word sneering, and he said, "Change is hard and change makers need support, not derision, not our derision, not our scorn." Rant over. Simon signed off, and Happy New Year. Well, Happy New Year to you as well, Simon. And no hard feelings. We have had some correspondence this week. All very good-natured. A lot of good-natured joshing in there. I told Simon that I was not going to take lessons on where cycling was going, should go, from a man who thinks that cyclocross is the future. He's a big fan of cyclocross. Anyway, Lionel, to go back to the original point. Tour Down Under. This got me thinking. The Tour Down Under... 26 years ago, or whatever we established, whenever we established it started, this was sort of newfangled. This was an attempt to broaden the calendar, broaden audiences.
I remember it well. Yeah, 1999, the first edition of the Tour Down Under, won by Stuart O'Grady. And there was all sorts of talk in the lead up to it about whether riders would go to the other side of the world in what would have been kind of training block for them, looking ahead at the European season. I think the difference with the Tour Down Under is that it was taking the sport to an audience that existed, and that has been proven over the last 26 years and however many editions it is, because the crowds are huge. There's a very warm welcome for the peloton there every year, and it wasn't exactly reinventing the wheel, was it? It was genuinely taking a world-class event. And let's remember, it wasn't an elite top event when it first started. I think at the time it was rated 2.4 on the UCI's kind of ranking of stage races. So, you know, quite a long way below, you know, the Tour de France or even things like Paris-Nice or the Dauphiné. But it was just... it was a start, and it was a successful start. And now, of course, it is the opening event of the World Tour. And it's been a huge success, taking the top riders and creating a top event, a top stage race in a country like Australia, which, although it's the other side of the world, it has a very rich heritage and history of cycling. So it's kind of, you know, I don't want to use the phrase preaching to the converted, but it was tapping into an audience that there was a degree of confidence that would be there and would turn out. I think, okay, I'm quite happy to be accused of being sceptical about one cycling. I think sneering's a little bit much, and I'm certainly not writing it off before we even see the details of what it is. But let's just deal with what is in the public domain at the moment that we can confirm. One Cycling is a company, One Cycling Limited, set up with one person with significant control, and that is Richard Pluger, of course, of Visma Lisa Bike. His ownership of shares is more than 50%, but less than 75%. And I suppose what I was trying to say earlier was we have sort of been here before, with first with Velon, which Richard Pluger is also involved in, that somehow there's a grand reveal just waiting to happen. And so the details of what One Cycling is going to be and how it's going to reshape, remodel the sport are yet to be revealed. And I think I'll save my knee-jerk reaction for when we see a few more details, perhaps. But I do think that there's a lot to unpack. We could probably do a sort of mini-series on what it is that has drawn people into the sport. Simon Mottram there mentioned younger people and also decline. Now, I'm not sure I see that decline. What I see, certainly from a British perspective, is that we had a huge boom in popularity, which was driven by national interest, really, success by British riders. I mean, I'm looking at the Tour Down Under start list. I think I counted up 14 British riders are taking part. So, you know, that the kind of long tail of that boom of success is still apparent. But what we don't have is the kind of the global superstar status of, you know, Bradley Wiggins, Mark Cavendish and others, you know, driving that popularity. I think from my point of view, as a kid, I was exposed to lots more golf or tennis, athletics, Formula One. I barely saw any cycling. I wasn't really exposed to it, but I was introduced to it by my dad, and that kind of drove my interest. And so I think this idea that somehow appealing to young people is just like pressing a button, creating something. You have to show people and expose people to the sport at a young age. And the way to do that is to make it much, much easier to see, either on television or, as is increasingly the case, take cycling to where young people are going, which is, you know, online, gaming, apps, all of these kind of things. I mean, I'm starting to sound like a fuddy-duddy here myself, aren't I? But so I can certainly see if One Cycling is going to unveil a kind of a blueprint for exposing cycling in an affordable, accessible way.
They need to be
way.
On Nintendo, don't they?
they do. Yeah. Then I think, yeah, great. But I'm kind of sceptical about this idea that there's some great storyline that no one's really seeing, or that we're missing something about cycling. And I suppose from Killian Kelly's point, I mean, and he was being slightly provocative, I guess. You know, the thing we hear is that we're always told that what will drive this kind of quantum leap in popularity is if we can see the best riders going head to head against one another as often as possible. And I just don't believe that. So, you know, I'm quite happy to be proven wrong. And I think I'll wait and see a bit more, you know, detail on what One Cycling is actually going to be before passing comment. But what I will say is I think perhaps we should throw it over to the listeners, maybe in the 11:01 cappuccino. I'll put together a few questions and we'll solicit some answers from our listeners. What is it that they, as current fans of cycling, would like to see? And what do they think would be appealing to attract more viewers to watch professional cycling and really engage with the sport?
Maybe even Lionel over a lukewarm pint of musty ale in the Cannibal in Badger, which is our which is our concession to advancing technologies, the social media platform that we invented.
Listen. I don't want to get involved, and I actually still need to visit the Cycling Podcast own version of Truth Social and get on there and have a look. All seriousness, guys. We see this in bigger sports as well. You know, you've got the boss of the Olympics saying we need to get younger people involved. We need to get more. This is a crisis that isn't unique to cycling. I say crisis in inverted commas because some people think it is, others think it isn't. Perhaps it's just the natural progression of society and everybody's attention spans at least less and less. And yes, we have to work hard. And I work for a broadcaster and, you know, part of my job is trying to get more people into it, trying to get different eyes on it. Of course we want to make more people involved. Of course we want to get more eyes on cycling. Who doesn't want to expand the audience? I mean, I don't disagree with you, Lionel, but talking about your point on the Tour Down Under there, I don't think there's anything wrong in wanting to expand and being ambitious, having cycling going to new territories and things like that. However, I'm certainly with you, Lionel, on the let's wait and see, because we still don't know what it is. And that's what I'd like to hammer home. We have no idea what the project is yet.
Can I just make one other point, Daniel? Because, you're talking about young...
We're going to hear from a young person in a minute. We are.
Balance.
you talk about what engages young people with sport. And, you know, there's two strands to that, isn't there? There's participation and there is watching, either live or on TV or however you watch your sports these days on your newfangled tablets and telephones. And I think, you know, participation, that is an issue, making cycling appealing to younger people and
affordable, Lionel. Yeah. I think that's the biggest issue affordability that this sport has
as well. Yeah. So if One Cycling came in and said, right, we are going to make this this league of events available for anyone to watch as easily, friction-free watching, free from, you know, parting with any money, you know, that would probably do the greatest service for professional cycling and its popularity that you can think of. But we know that really there's also a business motive behind that. And I'm not knocking that. That's fine. Absolutely. But I think we should also be, you know, honest about what or the people behind One Cycling should be honest about what their twin motives or multiple motives are. The very last point I want to make is that if there is an influx of cash from either the Saudi public investment fund or any other source, you know, corporate money, there's a really significant balance that professional cycling and the race organisers will have to strike. And that is the one thing that is not, I think, addressed or appreciated enough that is unique about professional cycling is that there's a huge balance between private enterprise and public in the form of governments, local authorities, taxpayers, basically the cooperation that allows races to take place on public roads. And I think if there was a huge influx of cash, you know, to on the private side, on the company side, the team owners, the race organizers and what have you, then I think that there would be a conflict, there may be even be a sort of a breakdown in that goodwill. A conflict between the use of public resources for the benefit of a professional sport and the private enterprise side. And I think that's something that, you know, one of the things about the Tour de France is the huge support that that race has from the French state. The government, the police, just to name a couple. And that's the trade-off, isn't it? It's a soft power instrument for France, the Tour de France. And I think, you know, just seeing professional cycling as if it's a kind of stadium sport that takes place on public roads is perhaps a little bit naive. I'm not necessarily saying that that is, you know, something that One Cycling haven't considered. I'm sure they have. But there's a little bit more to it than just sort of demanding that the sport becomes more popular. I think it's a really interesting question, and it will be very interesting to see what the plans are. And Simon Mottram, I promise I won't write them off just as a matter of course. I will be open-minded to whatever it brings.
He says that and decked head to toe in MAP and Le Col and Decathlon.
Completely
I promise
untrue.
I promised we would hear from a young person. He's just about still young, because I noticed that he's only just coming up to his 30th birthday. That will come soon. That guillotine will come soon to Theo Gegenhardt, former Giro d'Italia winner. I and a few other journalists were granted an audience with Theo. He was, I believe, at the well, he was at the Little Trek training camp in Spain last week. And we spoke to Theo about coming season, but also about matters such as these. Our colleague Chris Marshall-Bell asked him directly about the One Cycling sort of plan blueprint. We're going to hear what Theo said in response in a second, and we're also going to hear me ask him about the general advances in the sport, speed of change. And again, Theo had some interesting points, I think, which pertain to what we've just been talking about. So let's hear from Theo Gegenhardt, shall we?
Theo, there's a lot of talk at the moment about the sports economic model, and I know you as riders are very sheltered from it and you're not involved in negotiations. The idea of having the best riders race against each other on a more regular basis, I mean, as fans, that is exciting because we want to see that. But do riders want that? Or is there a risk of saturation that actually you ride so much together that it becomes less exciting?
I don't know. I don't think that's something I've heard opinions on, actually. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the narrative of the sport needs to be clearer, needs to be easier to follow. The marketplace for sports entertainment is ever more crowded, and with new competition all the time in e-gaming and, you know, in applications, things that I probably don't even know exist, capturing the attention of young fans. And I think cycling, you know, really needs to make more of an impact on young people and inspiring young fans, as well as people that have been fans of the sport for a long time. I don't think that's about changing the fundamentals of the sport, but I think the calendar being easier to understand would help a lot. I think the intricacies of cycling is something that people love once they are really inside the sport. There is always another layer to understand and, you know, a new race to discover and a new history to uncover. But equally, I think the year having a bit more of a rhythm to it that also makes a little bit more sense to the casual fan would help all involved. Whether that means the big riders competing against each other more regularly, it's hard to say, because I think, yeah, you could compare it to, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a good example, maybe tennis, where they have the smaller events and then they have the big grand slams and whatnot, but there is only a few. I think, I don't know exactly, it's four or five, if I'm not mistaken, in the year. And I think in cycling, yeah, that's never going to be realistic, because we have so many amazing races and it's also not possible to target every race as a rider. I think you could also then end up with even less diversity of winners than we have now. And I think actually cycling really needs that element of unexpected and fairy tale stories. I think that is something that, you know, really gives people inspiration to follow the sport. So, yeah, I think for me, like, especially if I was going to like really propose some reform, I would also probably start waking up to the fact that the environment, particularly the weather conditions, have changed than 30 years ago. And the calendar probably could do well to have some adjustments with that in mind. It would make a big difference for the riders and the organizers, because the last thing that anyone wants to see is these, you know, races getting stopped or issues every year that we are now having. And it's obviously becoming more common, and the weather is getting more extreme. So, of course, it's difficult, but I think there is some adjustments you could make from that side to at least make things a bit easier, perhaps.
Would you perhaps suggest starting the season earlier or what? Or maybe even having a break in the midsummer?
I don't think it should start earlier. I think it's going to become the one line of this interview, I guess. But I think just looking at, you know, which races are regular. I mean, in the end, the sport is doing a super good job of analysing big data sets now compared to 10 years ago. Of course, the world has changed in regards to that. It would be very easy to do an analysis of which periods and which races are kind of regularly having issues and the level of issue, because actually for me, like, adverse conditions is part of cycling. Like, no one ever going to forget some of these mythical stages where riders have done amazing things in very tough conditions, but there is a limit also, and especially with the heat, I think.
I think it's in everyone's interest probably in the end. You don't want to reinvent cycling. I think that's the last thing anyone should do. I think the history and the kind of heritage of the sport is the most amazing and also important thing that we have. It's going to be in the fans, the riders, the teams, the organizers' interest if one race that is regularly struggling with conditions which are on the limit, like, it can find a better moment.
Taylor, just I suppose as well about the development of the sport. There are times when cycling seems to move forward, the standard, the level seems to move forward in small steps, and there are other times where it seems to make big leaps in short spaces of time. Just so being around some of the big teams this winter, it feels as though a lot of the bigger teams are really kind of tooling up. They're kind of worried about, or they're thinking about AI, they're thinking about, you know, the big sort of revolution that's been in nutrition over the last couple of years. And it feels as though there's a real fear of being kind of left behind because we are in a phase of rapid development. Do you feel that as riders? Do you get that sense that this is a period where things are moving very fast?
I mean, I think that's just endemic of the world that we live in. I, first time ever at Christmas, witnessed a conversation of someone questioning if they should change career because AI going to take their job. And I'm sure all 11 of you are looking over your shoulder at which supercomputer going to write the next great headline. But
wouldn't be hard to do better.
So far, I haven't seen it riding a bike. I'm sure it's going to come. Honestly, even a little bit, the sport is in a great place. Sometimes I find it surprising and I see how much kind of, not negativity, but news there is around the need for reform in cycling. I'm sure, like as you said, Chris, we are not privy to everything. There is people with much more knowledge than me and they know really what's going on behind the scenes. But, you know, if I see Lidl coming into the sport, if I see some of the other big partners which teams have taken in the last couple of years, headline massive multinational companies, I think that's a really good thing. I also have friends in many different endurance sports, and there is not 1,000 people making a very good living. And in cycling, there is. And I think it's really easy to forget that. So to speak a little bit about the teams are becoming better resourced because from my perspective, every year there is, you know, another big team or teams with a new sponsor or with more investment. Of course, that doesn't mean there isn't teams struggling and having difficulty to persuade a sponsor to sponsor them or to sell the project. I've no doubt that there is, but I think in the end the technological development of the world is massively accelerating at the moment. No one knows, you know, how the landscape of that kind of technology is going to look in 2 or 3 years, let alone 10. And the teams are looking for every and any edge to be better. I mean, that's the reality of elite sport. And I think you're probably going to find that also in sports with much less resource. They are looking just as ferociously for improvement because that's the reality of why do, you know, people run the marathon faster every year? Why do they, you know, more and more people break the 4 minute record? We put super shoes on you, Daniel. You're going to be running 3:53 tomorrow. It's the way the world is going, and I think the teams are not insulated from that. They are at the sharp edge of that culture. So also not something I would say feels has massively changed, actually. If I was to look back 10 years ago, I would say it felt the same then. Maybe now there is sometimes more resource in some ways, but I think actually maybe the teams are just a little bit bigger. I was listening to a podcast the other day and they were saying, like, it was the ultra runner actually was saying that he's doing everything he can now, like to the maximum, but he knows that in 10 years he'll look back and think, oh, why was I doing that stuff? Because that's so out of date. Like, now we are doing this, this and this. Like, it's the same in cycling. That's how it is. You know, we were doing things to the best of what we knew 10 years ago and now we do some stuff totally different. But that's how the times move. And yeah, everyone's so connected now that the moment one rider starts doing something, then they quickly tell their friends and things go around. And it's for me, cycling is very similar then. It's always been. It's just a different times.
Well, chaps, I said that was a sort of private audience, few journalists with Theo Gegenhardt, intimate gathering last week, and very interesting it was. Incidentally, Theo Gegenhardt's looking forward to, well, a different season from last year. Of course, he had that dreadful injury that he sustained, multiple leg breaks in the Giro d'Italia of the previous year, so 2023. He was on the comeback trail last year, started fairly promisingly, had a good start to the season, and got ill in the Dauphiné in June, and felt that that illness really jeopardized the rest of his season. He did do the Vuelta a España, but it didn't go too well for him. And he's taking things, well, in his own words, one race at a time this year. He's not committing to any grand tours particularly yet. We don't know whether he's going to do the Giro, the Tour de France, or the Vuelta a España. Incidentally, chaps, I also participated in another gathering with a little Trek rider yesterday. That was Jonathan Milan, who was riding the Tour de France in 2025, making his Tour de France debut. Mads Pedersen is being sent, or going, decided to go to the Giro d'Italia and the Vuelta a España, so they will not be teaming up in what would be a pretty formidable lead-out train at the Tour de France. But, of course, Milan will have his tried and tested lead-out train, I think, at the Tour de France. But that will be very interesting. Gatherings with journalists. There was another one last week. Rob, you were invited. I was invited to hear what Ineos Grenadiers are planning, hoping for, from 2025. Of course, when we touched on this as well last week, there was a little bit of sneering. Was there a bit of sneering?
No sneering.
Was there some sneering from Killian? Was there some parallel drawn with Manchester United? Anyway, I think what we all agreed on was that, and they agree as well, was that 2024 hadn't been a good season. Rob, we might go over, we'll touch on some of the points that were made, and we'll hear from some of the Ineos top brass that participated in that call in a minute. But just generally, what did you make of it all? It was about 45 minutes long, wasn't it? John Allard was there, the CEO, Scott Draw, who's kind of the performance director, Kurt Aslar-Arveson, who's returning to the team as a director sportif, Zach Dempster as well, director sportif.
I think we saw a group of people who were desperate to try and make a good impression, get off on the right foot. And I think that was probably necessary in our position. I mean, not always as much in my position in the commentary box, but you guys are often there gathering the facts on the ground and having chats with these people from all sorts of teams and all over the sport. And they seemed very, very enthusiastic about sort of not keeping things too quiet. I don't want to use the word hiding, but getting towards there. Because, of course, towards the end of last year, it was just rumour and conjecture, wasn't it? Whether it was about Pidcock, whether it was about the coaching restructure, the umpteenth coaching restructure in the last few years, the backroom staff. Again, I have to say, there seemed to be quite a bit of training and marketing speak, and maybe that's just the culture of the team and the way it's run, and, you know, the sort of high-performance language that to us is either fans, commentators, journalists, you know, that sort of goes over our heads a little bit. There certainly seemed to be plenty of method there, plenty of enthusiasm there, and a will to try and turn things around. But, there, you know, a couple of things jumped out at me with, you know, they talked about getting sprint coaches involved. And I think I asked, well, you know, I'm looking down the roster and there's not one single sprinter there. So why didn't we sign a sprinter? And then the response came, well, and that, to be fair to them, you know, there was a method to the response as well. So, well, we just want to make everybody faster, don't we? It's not just about winning. But I think, you know, a sprint is something the team could be crying out for just to get back to winning ways, really.
Maybe we will touch on that in a minute. Shall we hear first, before we go on, from a few of, well, I named them a second ago, CEO John Allard, Scott Draw, performance director. I think that's his title. It's something that means performance director. Anyway, Zach Dempster as well, one of the direct sportifs. Chaps, I put to them all of the nasty things that everyone, including us, have been saying about them. I sort of listed all the criticisms that have been levelled at that team over the last few months and saw what they had to say for themselves. Let's hear their responses, shall we?
I'm not suggesting that you guys should pay that much attention to what the media says, but I'm sure you are vaguely aware of what the sort of narrative has been around the team. So I know you're disappointed with the results, but there've been, you know, lots of criticisms from, you know, Ineos have a mixed record generally in sport, especially in football. The recruitment's been poor. There's something wrong with the coaching. This team's got a huge budget, which is not being spent well. It's lost, the team's lost its identity, made a mess of the Pidcock situation. I'm just listing them here. Too many sort of easy renewals of experienced riders. Too much non-cycling specific expertise has been brought in. I just wanted to know from you guys, of all the criticism that you have been aware of, what do you think has probably been fair? And what's the one that probably has not been fair, would you say, or inaccurate?
Yeah, thanks, Daniel. I think you're right. We're aware of all of that. We obviously don't do everything we do because of the media reaction to it. I think that all of those things are possibly a manifestation of what I would call a kind of an annual step and repeat approach to what we do and what we've done. Clearly, as a team that has a very proud legacy around performance and innovation and excellence, when things are working, it's very unusual to radically change them. And I think that we possibly didn't see well enough the changes that were happening in other teams and in the nature of racing. So I think a lot of those things, not for me to judge, but a lot of those things I think are manifestations of us having a tried and true approach at a time when we really needed to be changing, not just last year, but in the years previous.
Zach?
For me, like as a sport director, this isn't my only team. I started my team career in Israel, and it was much more of a bit of a guerrilla racing approach where we would hunt stages with Hugo and Clarkie winning stages in the tour. And I think coming here, the thing we've reflected on now is how do we race? What are we doing? Where are the opportunities within grand tours and stage races with the talent we have? Because for everything that is written about the team, we've still got a really, really strong roster with guys that can do really, really special things at the highest level. So finding those opportunities and preparing for them and getting guys racing like that throughout the season, not just at the big hits, I think that's the big thing that we reflected on. And that's not only on the riders, it's maybe even more so on us as a performance team. So yeah, we've been hard at work doing that. I think there's been really good examples of it, especially, you know, in the Giro over the years and in how we've targeted specific stages with special guys and created those moments that we're ultimately trying to get after this year.
Scott?
Just to add to some of that, Daniel, so it's, I guess, first experience of working with the cycling media in that sense, because my previous engagement with the team was probably a bit more in the background. But I like some of the things that get floated just aren't true, you know, and I completely disagree with them at any point. The idea of non-cycling expertise, I just look at Kurt, Zach, Geraint, riders, like the level of experience and nuance about understanding the flow and other sports there. What we do is complement that with world-leading expertise outside it, and that's where you get the magic. So like when those statements are made, we just try in some senses, we choose to ignore them. But I think people raise them without really understanding the detail. Yeah, Kurt's been part of the team. Gene's been part of the team for years. So we have get that balance right. I think often the other way can be detrimental. Having too many people just from one specific domain, I think that can limit your willingness to explore, experiment and do different things as part of the team. And the more that we do, the better we will be. So it's been an interesting experience in that first 6 month period, just getting to know some individuals and understand how that works. Some of it's frustrating to hear because you know it's just wrong and it's not based on context and facts. And I think that'll be part of my experience to understand how best to respond to that. But in some of the things I just completely disagree with, and that non-cycling expertise is one. If anyone, like you take somebody that really understands high performance and then to go into any sport, there's some pretty key critical things you always look for. And I think it's always how you supplement that to give you the capacity to grow.
Lionel.
Well, I think they took that pretty well, to be honest. I mean, you weren't sneering, but that
no,
was
I wasn't. And to be honest, I didn't quite get to the bottom of the list.
Daniel could already see the eye roll movements. Yeah, no, to be fair, it wasn't they took it really. It was very good humor, wasn't it?
But there's some interesting responses, I thought, particularly John Allott suggesting that they had used a bit of a copy-paste for a few years. They had, well, stayed sort of true to this mantra of you don't change a winning formula. And that had led to sort of complacency. But Lionel, this is the sort of Faustian pact that all really successful sports teams are drawn into, isn't it, I suppose, or the difficulty.
As I listened to that, that was one of the notes I made, because one of the most difficult things in elite sport, it strikes me, is identifying the change that's needed when you're at the top and being able to dictate the change rather than reacting to the change. That must be very, very difficult. You know, before, you know, they've sort of woken up at the start of 2025 after what was, you know, by any measure, really, the worst season in the team's existence. Even worse, really, than 2010, which didn't go to plan, but from which they would have learned an awful lot about professional cycling, their first season. You know, I remember
sounding a bit like Ruben Amorim at this point.
I remember meeting Dave Brailsford at the end of that season, and we'd had a rocky old relationship through that year anyway, because I suppose I'd been fairly critical, without sneering, about their performance.
Did you have a list? You also have a list?
I did have a list, actually, yeah, and I just... because Team Sky came in with, you know, the biggest budget, and they were going to change cycling, and Bradley Wiggins was going to win the Tour de France. And we are going back a long way now, aren't we? It's 15 years ago now, but it's just, I remember it as clear as day. And of course, they didn't, you know, they didn't create the revolution overnight. They found it a lot harder in that debut season. And Brailsford at the end kind of cut quite a sort of, a slightly humbled figure, really, and he accepted that he needed to go back to the drawing board and work out why all of their great ideas that they'd had on paper hadn't actually translated into winning the biggest races as they had hoped to do. Now, they had a lot of misfortune and what have you, and there are, you know, there are so many Brailsfordisms that you could quote, controlling the controllables and all of the rest of that. But it does, as I said last week, and I don't want to retread old ground, Ineos Grenadiers, just to look at the roster, if you just look at it and just glance at the names, it looks like a team lineup that has just lost its way. There's maybe a few of the older riders that I'm sure still have a great function in the team, but they're kind of clogging up a space. Maybe should have been moved on a little bit earlier. Some bizarre-ish, to me anyway, signings. I mean, nothing against Bob Jungels, a very fine rider, but I just don't see how that's a kind of marquee signing for a reboot. There's some very, very talented youngsters that we know about, of course. But it's kind of missing a talisman. You know, Geraint Thomas obviously is a sort of totemic figure. You know, he is kind of Sky Ineos. You know, he retains the DNA of the team from its most successful years. Will always be synonymous with it. But you know, 38 and possibly in his final season, not the rider to build the team around, I would suggest, although he may well have one last day or two in the sun. And so that kind of leaves a team bereft of a sort of obvious charismatic leader. Carlos Rodriguez is a great talent, but he's quite a quiet rider, isn't he? I don't mean personality-wise, although it strikes me that way as well, but it's certainly a sort of quiet rider on the bike. He's not a sort of, you know, up and at him type of rider that's going to rally an entire team behind him. And so it just seems to me to be a team slightly bereft of an identity of what it's trying to do. And I suppose I took from listening to the likes of John Allott and Scott Draw talking, they're wrestling with all of that. What is the team going to be? What is it defining identity going to be? And I think, you know, when your backs are against the wall, going back to basics, and we can slightly mock, we want everyone to be faster, don't we, Rob, is how you paraphrased it, but kind of, yeah, they need to get some wins on the board one way or the other, and work to the strengths that they do have, and kind of try to almost reboot the you know, restart the engine off the back of, you know, rediscovering some of the fundamentals and recognizing that they have been overtaken. That's really the first time that I've heard anyone at Ineos kind of being honest enough in public to say we have kind of been left behind a bit here. And I always think back to that special episode that Richard Moore made for the Cycling Podcast about Jumbo Visma a few years ago when they had Ineos in their sights, or Team Sky as it was then, in their sights. And we even called the episode Chasing Sky. And I think the only people who've been almost... they've been kind of I don't want to say asleep at the wheel, but they didn't notice until it's too late that not only had teams drawn level with them, but they've gone past. And I think the first step to recovering a place at the very top of the sport is to recognise that and be honest about that internally and also outwardly. And I think there's the first steps may well have been made.
Just two things that I would add to that, Lionel. One, you talked about the roster there. My fear, and I don't know whether I said this in the podcast last week, is that if you look at the roster, you could see how individually there are an awful lot of riders there who could have a brilliant season and not win a race. Riders for whom second places, third places in big races would be fantastic results. And unfortunately, we all compute and rationalise things in professional cycling in terms of victories. And even John Aller and Scott Draw, they were referring to victories last week. So I would say that's a concern. The other thing is that, you know, you talked about building an identity, recreating, remodeling an identity in professional cycling. And professional cycling teams are such disparate entities. And I would suggest that never is a sort of imprint or an identity that a team's management hopes to impose. Never is it stronger than at this time of the year. So there have been two camps where the team has lived together for, and it's still not a huge amount of time, it's only 3 weeks. So you can come out of the winter feeling really determined that you're going to race in a certain way, you're going to behave a certain way, you're going to do things in a certain way. And I think you could almost see that in the first two stages of the Tour Down Under. Even yesterday on a couple of the climbs, there was some of that, you know, what Zach Dempster referred to as that sort of guerrilla racing style that he had seen at Israel a few years ago, a shift in mentality. We've often sort of decried the lack of that at Ineos, the lack of sort of mob-handedness. It's always been very kind of prescribed, and robotic is a word we've often used. So I think we will see some of that, and we'll see it a lot at the start of the season because it's fresh in their minds. However, if it doesn't work, I just fear that it could get a bit ragged. But let's hope for on their behalf that that doesn't happen and that they do get rewarded.
Very quickly, the enthusiasm was certainly there. And again, you know, I might have been blinded by all the training and high performance terms and almost sort of the marketing sell was there, wasn't it? But I think in good faith, I'll buy it for now. But, you know, we'll have to see how it plays out on the road.
Will they get more wins than Manchester United in...
That's not hard though, is it?
Well, funny you should mention football, chaps, because there is a game kicking off in just a few minutes. I think that just about covers it for this week. Next week, we will be back to find out what happened in the Tour Down Under. And Lionel, unless you've got anything to add, go on.
Well, I was going to say one thing we didn't mention, and it did get brought up in one of the pre-Tour Down Under press conferences. Geraint Thomas was asked about Caleb Ewan and whether Caleb Ewan might have a slot in Ineos Grenadiers. It's a bit of a mystery, this. I don't know whether either of you guys know what is going on with Caleb Ewan. Technically still contracted, I think, to Jayco Alula, but seems to be missing in action at the moment. I don't know what's going on, but Geraint Thomas did acknowledge that yes, Ineos Grenadiers could do with a sort of out and out bunch sprinter capable of winning Grand Tour stages. That's not to say they haven't got some fastish finishes, but they haven't got a sort of, you know, an A-list sprinter, have they? But we'll have to see what happens with Caleb Ewan as the weeks go by.
There was some kind of negotiation earlier in the winter, or maybe a very short-lived negotiation that went cold, and it seems as though Ineos might be back sort of in the, well, whether it's a race at this point for Caleb Ewan or they might be interested again, something might happen. Astana, of course, were going to sign Caleb Ewan, going to take him from Jayco Alula, and Alexander Vinokourov, the team manager, got cold feet for some reason, and this has sort of left Ewan in the lurch. Jayco apparently not particularly wanting him anymore, and him not particularly wanting to stay there, but kind of homeless.
Well, not contracted then for 2025?
He was contracted. He was contracted. Yeah, I thought so. And I suppose, I imagine still is, but I think both parties have sort of resolved not to carry on together at the time of recording.
Well, 63 pro wins, gents. 63 pro wins, lots of Grand Tour stages, a super palmarès, but one which at the very top level has started to dry up, hasn't it? The last World Tour win for Caleb Ewan was almost 3 calendar years ago now. That was at Tirreno Adriatico. Last Grand Tour stage wins were at the 2021 Giro d'Italia. That win for Egan Bernal, just to put that into perspective as to how long ago that feels already. He's only 30, though. So there's still time, and you think there's still the speed if he is to be given another chance.
Chaps, the Tour Down Under, we'll finish on... Which day is it, chaps? The Tour Down Under will finish on...
At the weekend.
At the weekend. Who's going to win? Well, my tip for the Oka jersey at the top of Old Wollongong Hill. No, it's not at the top of Wollongong Hill. It's in Adelaide. After stage 6 is Finn Fisher-Black, the Kiwi of Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. I mentioned earlier in the podcast that he has just signed for that team from UAE. Another young Kiwi, Lawrence Pithy, has also signed for that team this year. I spoke to both of them together in Mallorca just a couple of weeks ago. Lionel, you'll be there next week. Rob, you'll be there next week. We're going to hear from that pair, Pithy and Fisher-Black. They're going to play us out, in fact. And we are going to wish you a good evening. And I'm going to thank you, Rob, and thank you, Lionel.
Thank you. I'm off to buy Lionel's cereal for next week. See you later.
Thanks, chaps.
Probably known each other since like 13, 14 years old, I reckon. So good 8 or 9 years already. We kind of grew up racing together. Yeah, I remember back in Paris this year, we were already kind of throwing up ideas like, oh, it would be nice to be racing on the same team next year. And a couple of months later, we found out it would be going ahead. So,
for those who don't know New Zealand, just explain the geography. You say you race together. You're from a similar part of New Zealand?
From like probably 5 or 6 hours drive apart. But in New Zealand, everyone races against each other because it's not such a big community there. We grew up, yeah, nationals all together, and also, yeah, junior tours around the country.
Yeah, both from the South Island, so yeah, it's pretty close. Now we live in the same place, we live in the same town, so yeah, back in Christchurch, so we'll do some training together when we're back in New Zealand. Growing up together, it was always nice to race with Finn, but also not nice because he'd always smoke me.
Was it ever a bitter rivalry?
Nah, it's never bitter. I mean, we're always competitive on the bike, but always friends when we hop off, so... Yeah, I always looked forward to when Finn left the age group and I could have my time to shine again.
And then did you start to clean up after that?
Yeah, for 1 year, and then I'd be back in the same age group as Finn, so...
Tell us a bit about deciding to join this team, because you were both in teams where, you know, things were going pretty well. So why here, Finn, first of all, you?
I was looking for, yeah, some more opportunity. Missed out on a Grand Tour this year in UAE, so that was a big motive to realise that maybe it was time to leave. Yeah, I want to find the most out of myself, and I think that's by doing the biggest races. So, I'm here to kind of do that, go to the biggest races and see what I can do, really. So the idea was with me to go to the smaller races and try to get wins and kind of climb up the UCI ranking. But the thing that motivates me is the big races. I like, yeah, going to the smaller races as well, but yeah, to win the big races is my dream. It's why I'm doing the sport, and that's what I really want to find in myself.
I mean, you're one of these riders who, it seems like you've got so many different abilities. People might look at you and say, well, we don't really know what he's going to be yet. Do you have a clear idea?
This year was really, I was finding out more about myself. In the beginning of the year, I kind of realized I do have this punch to me, which I really try to utilize. And I think, now I've found a way I can win races, and I'm really trying to dial into that. And really this, like, for example, the your Toronanda, your Ardennes, all these kind of 1 week GC races I can also do to really hone into that punchy finish and punchy finals. That's what I'll try to focus on next year, go to as many as I can and see what I can do.
Lawrence, of course, Groupama had given you the opportunity to turn pro, and then, well, the rumours started to sort of circulate early last year that you were going to move. Just tell us again why you decided to come here.
I think the main reason I came here was because I couldn't say no to the opportunity. Like the project and vision that Ralph and the team here approached me with, yeah, it was something I just couldn't say no to. It's a super professional environment here, and with Red Bull coming on, who doesn't want to be under that brand? So yeah, I mean, it was a big decision to leave Groupama. They gave me my shot, and they were the only team to give me the chance really when I first came to Europe, and they took a big risk on me. So yeah, I can only look back on that with fond memories and thank them for their opportunities. But I think it was time for me to move on and come into an English-speaking environment as well. I think I can really get the best out of myself here and become the best rider I can be.
I mentioned those rumours. People first started to talk about it around about the spring when you were, you know, really kind of in the limelight. I mean, am I right in thinking that that was when the decision was more or less made, sort of back end of the Classics period?
Yeah, I guess obviously you can't sign anything till middle of the year, but yeah, I'd made my decision pretty early on. With the riders, it was okay because most of them spoke English on the Classics team, but when it came to the DS, it was really hard, and there was a big cultural and language barrier. The way I wanted to race and the way I like to race sort of opposed some of their views. And it's just hard to get your point across in a different language when I'm stuttering French words. Yeah, it wasn't the easiest, but...
You don't want to trash French racing and French teams, but just talk about that difference in culture, about the way you want to race versus the way maybe you felt like they wanted you to race.
Yeah, I'd never say anything bad about Groupama. Like, it was a great team and they gave me the opportunity, but for sure it's different to other teams. I think already when you look at the DSs here and some of the interactions I've had, I can really be more myself, and it's more like a friendly environment. You've got super young DSs here that have retired from cycling quite recently. I mean, Heino, not long out, Shane, not long out, Bernie, all these guys, they're all not long out of the sport, whereas on Groupama, most of the DSs were older, who set in their ways a little bit. Mm. And when I'm coming in with not much experience with all these, I wouldn't say new ideas, but trying to think outside the box a little bit, can be pushed to the side sometimes.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.